Welcome to The Inevitable, a podcast by Motor Trend.
Welcome to another episode of The Inevitable. This is Motor Trend's podcast on the future of the car. Where are we going? How are we going to get there? Will cars have steering wheels? What are we going to eat when we arrive? What are we going to read or watch while we're waiting for the vehicle to charge?
Nice. See how I did that? Or while it's driving.
Or while it's driving.
TV while the car is driving.
Exactly. On this,
I have some recommendations.
He does, but surprisingly. My co-host, as always, is Johnny Lieberman.
And this is Ed Lowe.
It's me, Ed Lowe. As you know, head of editorial at Motor Trend, our lead influencer, car guy. Whatever you want to call it.
World's number one Bosch fan.
This is, yes, and not Robert Bosch GmbH, as I'll make a terrible joke. This is the Johnny Lieberman episode. The hits continue. We have his personal, one of his idols.
It turns out.
New York Times best-selling author of like 30-some crime novels. Michael Connelly. Some of you may know him from the series Bosch on TV.
Also the Lincoln Lawyer. You know what I'll do? I can just read about the author here.
Okay. Also, he's done The Lincoln Lawyer, which was a Michael McConaughey movie from like 10
years
ago.
Yeah, but it's also a Netflix show. But here, you want to just hear this here? Michael Connelly is the author of 36 previous novels, including number one New York Times bestsellers The Dark Hours and The Law of Innocence. His books, which include the Harry Bosch series, the Lincoln Lawyer series, the Renee Ballard series, and the Jack McEvoy, that must be the reporter.
McEvoy
series, sorry, have sold more than 80 million copies worldwide. That's a lot of books. Connelly is a former newspaper reporter for the LA Times who has won numerous awards for his journalism, almost won a Pulitzer, and his novels. He is the executive producer of three television series, Bosch Legacy, and The Lincoln Lawyer. He's also the producer of two true crime podcasts, Murder Book and The Wonderland Murders and Secret History of Hollywood.
And apparently, we might find out if Johnny can get past talking about the entire Bosch series, is apparently he's a car guy.
Yeah, that's how – so how this all came together was I'm friends with a producer on Bosch named Mark Douglas who owns a Rivian. He got a Rivian around the same time I did. We were just talking. He's like, yeah, you know, we had on the other podcast, Spike's Car Radio I do, we had Titus Welliver who plays Harry Bosch. We had him on. And I was talking to Mark about getting Michael on that show. And he goes, you know, he's kind of a car guy. He's really into Porsches and he's EVs. Really into EVs. And he's going to convert a Porsche to an EV. And I'm like, dude, we have to get him for The Inevitable. That's perfect.
Or we have to get him because I want to talk about Bosch.
Well, I could talk about Bosch. I could just start a Bosch podcast.
And for the record, I haven't seen a single episode. But
You're missing out.
Apparently, I'm going to start. Yeah. In the research of this, I did read up on Mr. Connelly, and I did listen to a podcast interview he did, and he's a fascinating guy. And what I really like, and this really should be, I should figure out a way to maybe highlight the L and the A in The Inevitable. This ends up being another, I think, conversation about how much we love Los Angeles and every part about it, because this guy, as Johnny mentioned, he spent a number of years as the crime reporter for the LA Times during a very interesting, pivotal year.
Yeah.
Years.
Yeah.
Of Los Angeles history. Not a great time in LA. A lot of strife. A lot of drugs.
Yeah.
A lot of crime.
A lot of murders.
And apparently,
a
lot of gangs. He was covering this beat and learned about LA because he's not from here.
So. Yeah, and then he did something great with it. Is he turned it into a really cool character and a bunch of cool books. And I think we should get him in here.
Let's do that. Let's
so,
welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael. Oh, wait. Michael Connelly, hang on. Before that, he has a new book. I don't know if you can see this, but you can't. Anyways, it's called Desert Star, and it's coming out November 8th, which I think should be 2 days after this episode drops.
Okay.
And it's the next Bosch book, and now the Bosch books are really Bosch and Renee Ballard. Together. So very excited about this. Last one.
You might have already used some pre-order, Johnny.
Pre-order. Renee Ballard had quit the LAPD, but I think she's getting back in. So very excited about that.
And so just to be clear, you're a fan, that you will buy these books and read them in hardcover?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Well, you know, he had been writing the books for 20 years before the show came out. So I watched – I didn't even know they were based on books. I had no idea. I was just like, oh, I remember Titus Welliver. He was on Deadwood. Like, he was a cool character. I like that actor. I like cop shows. And I was just like, well, this is a lot more than a cop show. This is a very cool show. And I realized there was like 20 books. And so, you know, I read one and just I read them all. I had to read them all.
And so then, you read the first one, Dark Echoes?
The Dark Hours, I think. I don't know. And they're all named. Like there's
some super fan.
I don't know the names of the books. You know, they all blend a little bit. You know what I mean?
I'm only asking because that's where I'm going to start after this interview. I'm going to start with this first one.
Honestly, I think I read them out of order. The first one I read was – the Black Echo is the first one. The Black Echo.
Okay.
Yeah, everything's dark, black. The first one I read was Concrete Blonde, which is actually a really good one.
Okay. I think that's the second one.
Yeah, second, third, fourth, something like that. Okay. It's in there. But what's cool about the show is – the show is never like one book. The show is like the best parts of three different books blended together makes up a season. And it's interesting how they have such a rich, 30-some novels to draw from. So it's like they never run out of ideas.
But there's no way the any of this stuff in the moving pictures is better than the written word.
I think it's
maybe we should ask him. Maybe we should ask him.
Yeah.
We'll ask him.
Yeah. My guess is the combination of him plus Titus makes it really magical. But anyways, without further ado, Mr. Michael Connelly. I'm kind of fanboying out a bit here because I'm a self-described giant Bosch fan, and just to put Mr. Connelly here on the
Robert Bosch GmbH from Germany.
Different Bosch. Just to let you know what the level of weirdness you're dealing with. I think I've seen seasons 1 through 4 five times.
Wow.
Season 5 three times. 6 twice. I've only seen the Bosch Legacy, which we call season 7. Only seen it once so far, but I know that they're actively filming the second season of that, season 8.
Yeah.
So, and I've read all the books. So I'm just really excited you're here. And then, I'm friends with Mark Douglas, who's a producer on the show. And he was like, you got to get Michael on. He's really into cars. And I was like, yes, we have to make this happen. So just welcome. Thank you for being here. And thanks for writing all the great books you read.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
And I represent the other side, which is I've heard about you from this guy, and I just read your Wikipedia page. I listened to one of your podcast interviews on the way up, and I am now fascinated because I think there's a lot of things about your past and your craft and everything that I'm very interested in, including the extent to which your work, the things you've done in your past, involve the car. So –
The car.
I don't know where you want to start, Johnny. But you.
Well, I would start here because I know you were a reporter, and I noticed, especially in the earlier Bosch books, like there was you really had the lingo down of like the homicide unit and just I guess lingo is the best term for it. But and I was just fascinated. Like, was that your beat? Was crime reporting?
Yes, I came to L.A. in 1987 to work for the L.A. Times and. I left in 94, so the whole 7 years I was either on police beat or you have a tendency to get burned out a little bit and they'll shift you around. And I was shifted to criminal court, so it's not that different, but it's a more of a 9-to-5 type job and not running after stories when they're happening. So the 7 years here were all crime related and, talked to dozens of cops a day, detectives mostly. Detectives.
Right. Yeah.
I just heard on this other one, the podcast, 75 to 100 per day.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You covered 7 police stations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
LAP.
One? Which ones?
LAP. All the North, they call it the Valley Bureau, the LAPD at that time had 5 stations. Now they've made it 7. But I also covered the North County. Sheriff's Department, Camarillo, Thousand Oaks, that was my territory, Malibu.
Wow.
And then going east, I had Burbank and Glendale. Somebody else had Pasadena.
Oh, crazy.
Wait, does that cover the most, any of the more notorious LAPD stations? Like, you didn't do Rampart, right?
No.
That would have been or south.
It was Foothill, where Rodney King happened.
Ooh. Yes, and, I know exactly where that happened.
And were you? Yeah. And you were here.
Yeah.
You were covered. Wow.
No, it was interesting, though. I was that was when they said, you're getting burned out, and they put me on courts in Van Nuys. So I wasn't covering it when it happened. Oh, and it's one of the LA Times' lasting embarrassments. They were scooped. Channel 5 News broke that story, got the videotape.
Right.
And, so I always felt like if you left me on the cop beat, I probably would have gotten that, but you had to move me into the courthouse. So.
But that's interesting just because, no one knows this. Like the Rodney King beating took place in so more practically. Yeah. It was like middle or off the 210, which no one knows. I know exactly where it happened.
Yeah,
so
Osborne and
Osborne, that's right.
Yeah.
And it's just to tie it back to Bosch for a second, because I noticed, like, you know, in the last few books when he got moved to San Fernando, you know, it's like that kind of area. So it's interesting that I didn't realize you were ever working up there.
Yeah, I was pretty familiar with that.
Oh.
Yeah, so I go to Foothill a lot. On the day of the verdicts, the LA Times had this plan of putting reporters strategically all around the city, and I was at the spot where Rodney King had been beaten because we knew there'd be a lot of people there to demonstrate what they thought would be guilty verdicts. And then when it was not guilty, things went sideways.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, let's talk about that for a second. Like, what was that like as a reporter covering the L.A. riots? That had to be.
Well, I mean, they were mostly on the south end. I was positioned on the very far north, at least on the first day. Then they moved everybody south. But it was very, you know, pretty surreal because there was a large gathering of people. There was nothing. It was basically like a gravel parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's an apartment building there.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's lots of people there, and again, I thought everyone was going to celebrate. You know, everyone, media, was kind of caught flat-footed by the verdict. And it was interesting. There's some TV trucks there, and they had their doors open, and they're showing. They have like all these screens of what's being shown on their channel, and people started seeing what was happening on the south end, and people setting fires and stuff. And then suddenly this peaceful group kind of got angry.
Right.
And I remember I got surrounded and some people pulled me away. You know, people I'll never know, but they probably saved me from getting a beat down. And then they all just marched down Foothill to Foothill Station. And the police stations, they kind of look like bunkers, but their fronts are glass. And so they quickly got a school bus and pulled a school bus up in front of the police station. Whoa. So no one could get in.
Oh, crazy.
They've since redesigned the stations to account for civil unrest. But it was, you know, one of those nights of my reporting career that I always remember.
Right. So, that's wild.
I want to go talk about everything you did in your time at the LA Times. But before you came to LA Times, you worked at a Florida paper.
Yeah.
And you actually were on a Pulitzer Prize finalist team for coverage of an air crash.
Yeah.
American flight?
No, it was a Delta flight that was left Fort Lauderdale, where I worked and where I grew up, actually. And it was stopping in Dallas and then going on here to L.A. And so a lot of the people on there were from L.A.
Okay.
And so me and two other reporters spent a year writing about, like, what caused the crash and everything that went through that. And then also, it was an odd thing because there were survivors, 29 people survived.
So microburst, like a weather event, right?
Yeah, it was the crash that made them put the microburst equipment on every plane.
Okay.
Was that the one that went down in the swamps? Was that the one?
No, it crashed in Dallas.
Oh, it was in Dallas. Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
and so we spent a year and then wrote this long, long thing that got a lot of attention, and we almost won a Pulitzer Prize. Basically, a finalist means you came in second.
Yeah.
But it caught the attention of the LA Times, so that's how I ended up at the LA Times.
And right. When you were there, so when you were in Fort Lauderdale, were you doing crime reporting as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, I wanted to – when I was in college, that was when I decided I wanted to try to write crime novels. And I kind of huddled with my parents, and they had – my dad had the idea of going to go to college, get a journalism degree, and then you get close to the kind of people you want to write about.
Yeah, and again, I mean, just being – like, that's what really struck me, because, you know, I saw the show first, and then I went back and read the books. And you know, the books have – you know, I'm sure you would agree.
Are the books better than the show?
No. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't know.
Look, I think they're better.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Say it. I'll let you off the hook. Just go ahead and say it.
I just think that I wanted – this is a question I want to ask. Like, like when you, all right, let's just jump to here. Like when you met Titus Welliver, like, no one else could play this role, right? Right? I mean,
yeah, no, I agree. I think he's the keeper of Harry Bosch now. It's not
right?
me for sure.
It's incredible though. Like everything about, and, you know, I've interviewed him on another podcast, and just everything he's like, yeah, you know, the reason I wear the Rolex I wear on the show is because Bosch's character was an operator, and I had a lot of buddies who were operators, and they would always have a watch like that. They've got in Southeast Asia, and I'm just like, yes. You know,
he brings a lot of his own interest and so forth to the character because it's a younger character than the guy in the books.
Yes.
We're taking books that I've written 20,
30
plus years ago and putting them into contemporary LA. So there's a lot of changes and a lot of updating we have to do.
And if I can amend my answer for a second, I think the books got better as they progressed. I mean, the last one, the Ballard Bosch book, was great, you know, like, so.
Well, thanks. I mean, this will be the best podcast you've ever done, right? Because you get better at what you're doing the more you do it.
Absolutely.
So, you know.
God, I hope so.
The confidence, you know, your confidence gets better. So, you know, I would agree that I haven't written a perfect book yet. I'm working on that. But,
yeah, right.
But I think the books are what's the right way of saying it without sounding like a jerk, more accomplished, I guess, as I go.
Yeah, yeah. The writing. It gets, you know, more efficient, yet you retain the spark that makes it what it is, you know. And it's, yeah, I mean, I remember that last one I put it down. I was like, I can't wait to watch this is what I was thinking. Like, that's a good book.
But before we
– Yeah.
Something you said, which I heard about, again, in my research, and I read it too. Very clever from your father to say you want to write – so you knew at like, what, 18, 19, you want to do these – you want to write crime novels. But to go to school as a journalist and then become a reporter, get to know these people for the background, that's like some next level like planning. But the funniest thing is, have you read your own Wikipedia page?
I probably glanced at it, but not in a
There's
long time.
A line in it that said, Connolly had planned on following his father's early choice of career in building construction and started at the University of Florida in Gainesville at the Rinker School of Building Construction, studying construction management. After earning grades that were lower than expected, Connolly went to see Robert Longo, but whatever. That, I thought that line was hilarious. Like, what grades were you expecting? What grades were you expecting?
Well, I like to call it a sabbatical, but I was kicked out.
I see.
So yeah. It was under it was like a 0.09 or something. You
wow.
know? And it was because they throw you into this, like, you know, I actually literally took a course called Concrete 101. and you know, that there's seven different recipes for concrete depending on what kind of stress you're going to put, all that stuff. All the physics of it. And it was like, I just started bringing mystery novels with me and reading them in class.
Right.
It wasn't going to work out. It wasn't, you know, I had grown up in high school and so forth working on job sites where my dad was. And, you know, it's an outdoor thing and you're using your hands and your craft, and then you get stuck in a classroom for
studying rock
for 12 weeks about concrete, you know. It's like, so it didn't work out. And at that same time, I really was doing a deep dive into crime fiction, and that's when the spark hit. And
always fiction?
Well, I had this experience when I was a kid, younger, like 16, where I was a witness in a crime investigation, and I spent a night in a police station with a detective, and that really it was like so out of my world. I grew up in, you know, middle class, pretty much crime-free neighborhood, and it was like just a decisive night in my career. And then I started reading the crime stories in newspapers and then true crime. And then eventually I started reading fiction.
And you never wanted to be a detective?
No, I mean, because it's still pretty much this way. You don't sign up to be a detective. You end up in a uniform and it could be years. And
sure.
I don't have that. That's not me.
Right.
In a uniform, giving tickets or telling people what to do or wading into fights. And
Right.
I couldn't do that. That's not my character. So I would have loved to have been a detective, but there was no real way to get there.
Right. There's no quick way in.
Yeah.
What was this? was the incident when you were younger. I think I read it. You had witnessed someone put a gun or throw something into the bushes and you went back to look at it and you found a gun?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what you were interviewed about?
Yeah. It was, they didn't use that phrase back then because this was like 72 or something. I can't remember. 73. It was a carjacking gone bad, although they didn't have that phrase back then.
Right.
And I didn't see any of that. I was sitting at a traffic light in a Volkswagen Beetle, since this is supposedly be about cars.
Yeah, eventually we'll get there.
And, and I saw this guy running and I saw him stick something into a hedge, and it was late at night. I was coming home from a job as a dishwasher at a resort. And, no other cars around. As soon as the light turned green, I made a U-turn and went over and pulled it out. It was a shirt wrapped around a gun.
Oh, wow.
And then, again, this is so long ago, there was a phone booth. So I ran to a phone booth and woke up my dad. I called him and said, this is what I did and all that. And as I'm talking to him, like, cop cars come racing all through the neighborhood with their lights on. So I knew something had happened. So he told me to flag somebody down. I did, and led him to the gun.
Wow.
And the guy had run down the street and gone into this bar. It was a biker bar, you know, lots of motorcycles out front. He looked like you, long beard and all that stuff. And so they went in there and cleared everybody out. I don't know what the civil rights section, but anyway, everyone in that bar was put on a bus and taken to the police station. So I spent the night looking at them in lineups.
The purple, you did the whole thing. You did the lineup.
Yeah.
Wow.
You were how old?
16.
This is in Florida?
Yeah, in Fort Lauderdale.
Wow.
And then the detective told me, you know, a guy tried to steal a car at gunpoint. The guy wouldn't give up his car, and he shot him.
Wow.
And then ran. And you know, that bar had a back door because they didn't have the guy, but it became a big thing of contention with the detective thinking I'm this a kid that's afraid to point the finger. And I wasn't. I mean, I was probably stupid, but I would have. If they had the guy, I would have ID'd him.
They didn't have the guy.
They didn't have, not one by one, but several lineups of these guys with biker guys with Hell's beards Abrams, and right. stuff.
Wow.
That's wild.
Well, let me ask you this. So you're from Florida, but what I've always admired a lot about the books and the show, Bosch, is that you really use L.A. as a character. And especially, I talked about this with other people, especially with the show, but like food. I always love, like, you know, that you really get the food and like where people from L.A. tend to eat. So when you got here, was it 30 years ago? What'd you make of L.A.? And then how did you decide, longer than 30 years ago, but how did you decide that, like, you know, this would be where I think all your books are focused in L.A.? I mean, I know Ballard and...
Well, one of them called The Poet starts in Colorado, and maybe that's where you thought I was from Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's the one I haven't read.
The Reporter.
Yeah. But Ballard...
But it ends up in L.A. Everything is really L.A.-centric.
Yeah, yeah. So can you talk about, like, your first impressions of L.A. and how... I mean, I'm assuming you like the place.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to – I mean, that's the story I wrote about the plane crash got me a lot of interviews around the country. Like, I went to Chicago. I went to the Orange County Register, and then I went to the LA Times. But I was hoping the LA Times would hire me, and they did. And it's because my knowledge of LA – I never stepped foot into LA till I came for an interview with the LA Times. I was 30 years old.
Oh, incredible.
And it was all knowledge based on movies and books, Raymond Chandler, Chinatown, all that. And so
sure.
So I had a kind of like a magical view of what L.A. could be. And
did you read James Ellroy? Did you read Black Dahlia?
Yeah, read all those. I just was, for some, Ross McDonald, Joseph Wambaugh, all these were people I read before I got here. And to me, it matched what I had imagined it would be, or what I had seen and read, and so it was pretty exciting time. And
I mean, it was interesting to me. I remember when I first, you know, the first time I really heard. I mean, I saw the Lincoln Lawyer movie back in the day. It was just a movie, but when the Bosch show, the first season was, you know, centered in Echo Park, you know, and I thought, I'm like, that's like really insider, because I lived in Echo Park for years, And I'm like, that's – you got to be like an L.A. – you know, you'd never put a story in Echo Park. You know what I mean? Like unless it's like a gang drama or something like that.
For those listening, Echo Park is where you go to get a fake ID amongst
– well, heroin back in the day. mostly heroin when I lived there. But yeah. It, you know what I mean? But it was, I was like, this is like, you know, some really insider stuff. And it's just not a, you know, it's not a, you know, all the people producing the show live in Brentwood or whatever, you know, it's not. So I was just like, wow, this is really cool. So,
well, when we started the show, we were kind of aware of what LA shows usually show. And we had this goal of never going west of La Brea.
Oh, nice.
We did a few times,
sure.
But generally, and that was also one of the borders of the LAPD Hollywood division. So,
right.
So it was like, Botch is going to be in Hollywood and so on. And so, yeah, we've always gone east or explored east. And,
oh, fascinating.
And we, you know, this was very careful design. I don't know if you want me to go into it, but.
Please, I'd love it. Yeah.
But the show opens with Botch and Edgar on a surveillance. And there's a street, I can't remember the name of it offhand, but it's on the ridge, up on the ridge of Echo Park. And you, if you look to your left, you can see Dodger Stadium.
Right.
And so we wanted that in the background. And, you know, we wanted them just sitting there listening to a game. And when the guy they're watching makes a move. And then the next part was we want this show to start with a black screen. And we wanted to hear the voice of Vin Scully because that's the voice of L.A.
Right.
And so you're asking me about the place as a character in the books
yeah.
and the show. That we were very aware of that.
Okay.
And what was interesting is so we went to MLB and said, can we get about a minute of Vin Scully calling a Dodger game? And they said no. And I had interviewed Vin Scully once, and like a good reporter, I kept his home number.
Oh, nice.
And so I kind of called him out of the blue, and he said he had tracked me and knew I was writing these books. And I said, I want to try to fake, you know, when there's a delay, you give all these wonderful trivia things.
Right.
And so we'd like to have the game have a rain delay, and you're just filling the radio space for about a minute. And I'll write the script, and I'll come to your house, and we'll record it. And
he goes,
yeah, I'd be glad to do it, but I'm going to write it. And so he did write.
Nice.
And it was all this trivia about how there'd only been five, not rain delays, but rainouts in the history of Dodger Stadium. And it was just this wonderful thing. And then we put it against some crowd noise and
right.
so forth. And so that's how it opens. And it opens
oh,
with
yeah. That's
Vin
brilliant.
Scully's voice, which is
did
so
the MLB try to come after you? Like, hey, where'd you get that? Say, huh?
No, because then they'd have to go after Vin because he did it. You know?
Right.
And,
right.
And so it's funny. You know, I'm a book writer. What do I know about TV? And this is the first episode, the pilot. And so there was some kind of fundraiser at the stadium. It was off season when I did this. And he goes, I'll be there and we'll find a space and we'll record it. And so I actually recorded it on an iPhone, and it's the first words you hear on the show. So I really felt like I had to earn my stripes as a producer.
Right.
Even though I had zero experience.
That's amazing. I mean, it's little stuff like that. Because, you know, again, as an L.A. native, it's very obvious. Like, somebody really likes this town that's making this show.
Okay.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Let's plug the pilot. Where can I watch the pilot? Is that on Amazon?
It's all on Amazon.
Amazon? Okay.
Yeah. It's also on Freevee, their free
fast
app
channel.
Thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in continuation of, because I also appreciate that, this is a guy who didn't grow up in L.A. but has a lot of L.A. in your veins and in the work you create. But I assume you got all this L.A. insider information from all of the interviewing and all the conversations you have with like 75 to 100, you know,
detectives
every day.
Well, they know where to eat.
Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some of them, they're like, is anything going on? No. Okay, talk to you tomorrow. So they're not like these deep conversations. But over time, you create end up with some sources that would be very significant in terms of telling me what's going on or what they've heard and all that kind of stuff. And it's a crowded market, the crime fiction market. And, you know, and I grew up loving Private Eye stories. So mm-hmm. I always thought I'm gearing myself towards writing a Private Eye story. But then I, you know, I'm, I'm reasonably smart, and I realize I have an entree into this world of one of the most famous police departments for notorious as well.
I was going to say most famous in this country.
And like that's what I got to use. So I got rid of the idea of writing a private eye story and said I'll write a LAPD detective. But I wanted to give him all the stuff you see in the private eye, you know, a guy who feels like he's an outsider.
Yeah, and he's it's wonderfully done. He is an outsider, and he's, you know, I mean, spoiler alert, he becomes a private eye several
Eventually
times.
Eventually, I got there.
So did you pick up this habit, skill, reporting style from Florida? Like, were you going into, like, is that how you do? I mean, what do I know about, like, the crime beat? Do you just go and visit and then you brought this? Was that unique to your experience as a reporter?
No, I mean, it's pretty much what you do. I mean, Fort Lauderdale was a real small market compared to L.A., and that was the kind of place where I could just, like, walk in. You know, you can't just walk into any LAPD facility, you know, and especially as a member of the media. They're very media savvy and centric, and despite all the stupid things they end up doing and videoing and all that. But they, you know, they view the media as the enemy, basically. Right. So it's very hard to make inroads and get sources going. So you do the 75 calls. It's almost like being a salesman. Like if you call 100 people to try to sell something, two will buy it, you know. Right. So you got to keep those numbers up. So eventually you'll find someone, you know, who will tell you and has a greater picture that, you know, the public has a right to know what's going on and not which is a very, very minor number of people in that bureaucracy.
So can you paint that picture? Are you so 87? Are you at, you're at the what's LA Times is now in El Segundo, but so you were in the building in downtown. Are you like at a desk? Not, you got a phone? Are you like call? You got your pad and you're like going through, or is this like you pay personal? You go. You don't drive to each one and walk in and.
Well, one thing you learn about LA is so spread out. And when I was in Fort Lauderdale, I went to the police station every day. They had one big police station, not all these satellite bureaus and everything. And so in LA, I had all that territory I mentioned before, but the most important thing was the LAPD. And then in Van Nuys, they have called the Valley Bureau, which is the command of the Valley. And, you know, I wouldn't go to every one of those places every day. I usually went to one. So I'd hit them all in a week. But it was mostly phone work. And, you know, I had a desk. It wasn't downtown. It was in the valley. They used to have a massive complex all the way up in Chatsworth.
Yeah.
And I worked there. I had a cubbyhole desk with I always had a police scanner going. And you got to remember, 87, there were no cell phones. The internet really.
Thomas Guide you were using.
Thomas Guide.
Yes. Kids at home, Google Thomas Guide right now.
Yeah,
it's funny. When we started the show, they still make those. You just don't – you got to order them online. And, you know, so I ordered a box of those and gave them, like, to Titus and everybody to study. But anyway, it would be by phone. You'd hear about a crime or, like, an investigation going on. You'd go to an editor. And they would make choices on whether to send you out because it's such a vast place and it might take me an hour just to get to something. So there was a big decision-making process on whether I would leave the office if the story or whatever was happening was big enough.
What were you driving?
Back then I had a
LA Times doesn't give you a car, right? It's a personal car you're logging.
Well, that office had four LA Times cars. I never wanted to use them, but often you'd go with a photographer, and the photographers always had scanners in their cars and stuff like that. My personal car back then was a Jeep.
Okay.
What is it? What do you think it is about Los Angeles, the LAPD specifically, that they have, you know, and I know a lot of the history of it, but like there is this level of notoriety of the LA Police Department, Chief Parker and, you know, Gates and Rodney King and all that stuff. But what is it about this place where the cops become so famous?
Well, I think it's three things. The media capital is here. The entertainment capital is here. So, you know, there's been so many shows going, you know, all the way to Dragnet and so forth. And so that's pushed LAPD out there into the world. And that's not lost on the people. You know, like, we use a lot of real cops on Bosch, and I've had very high-ranking people say your shows help with the esprit de corps. You know, people in the department, even though, you know, it's not all roses that you portray LAPD. You show a lot of the corruption and so forth, but they are willing to take the good with the bad because there's this guy, Harry Bosch, who's, you know, trying to do the right thing no matter what the circumstances. And so they connect with it. And I think, you know, that has happened over the decades with other shows and so forth. So there's that. We're right in the middle of the entertainment capital of the world in a way. And then there's also the innovation. They are an innovative department.
Right. You know, they invented mobile policing.
Yeah, they invented SWAT. They have the biggest police air force in the world, you know, 16 helicopters.
It's also the second largest police agency after NYPD, I believe. Yeah. But it has the largest geography by far.
Oh, by far. Yeah.
It's the I think the cop to whatever human population citizen is the ratio is like way off of like what it is in New York in terms of because even though the density is New York's very dense, they have way more people in a much smaller like area.
Yeah, I mean that's really the source of the problems with LAPD is long ago, and Gates was a big believer in this. He was the police chief when I was the old reporter. To save money and to be in the good graces with city council and the budgeters and all that stuff, he said he could police this city with 10,000 cops. You know, New York has between 25 and 35,000 cops.
Right.
And that created a police force that really stayed in cars, never really intermingled with the people they're protecting, and just chased the radio, just went from call to call to call. And so that meant you went to bad situation to bad situation to bad situation, bad guy to bad guy to bad guy, and soon everyone's a bad guy, and it created this us versus them.
Right. That's fascinating.
And, you know, and that's why they end up, you know, beating the hell out of Rodney King. You know, he wasn't a person to them.
It was very – that's – the way you just said it is very well depicted in – oh, man, was it – what was the cop movie with Sean Penn? What, his early days? Colors?
Colors, yeah.
Where you see them and it's the cops in the car rolling up and they, like, roll the window down and stare. And it's always usually, like, a black guy, the gangster on the other
end. But that comes from – I mean, Parker. Chief Parker is the guy that, you know, mobilized the police force. And then, you know, I learned this recently. Daryl Gates was his chauffeur. So they knew each other like very well. He was I read that, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know.
So Parker.
Wait, real quick. Did you ever interact with Gates?
Yeah, a few times, yeah.
What was that like?
It was all very well managed and so forth. I don't think I ever.
So there he had a PR person that kind of
a phalanx of people, you know. Trying to think if I ever had a one-on-one.
I mean, what would general, you know, I know what he looked like on the media, you know, like on the TV at least, I should say. Like, was he any different, or was he just presented that kind of bold?
With me, it was what you saw. You know, really sharp dressed, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Imposing guy, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was tall and.
Yeah.
So, I could talk about this stuff all day, and I plan to. So let's keep going. I think it's what you said is super interesting. Yeah, LA had all the beautiful people and all the powerful people in media. So yeah, Dragnet, you recall Dragnet, which is great. Which brings to mind one of my favorite movies that depicts this whole thing we talked about, which is LA Confidential.
Oh yeah,
and I always remember the Danny DeVito character in their Hush Hush magazine, right, where he's always trying to get the score from the cops, like give him a hot tip on something that's happening.
Give him $100.
Right. is any of that accurate? Like that's a terrible like way to say it. But is there any truth to that in terms of like getting hot tips, people with agendas, like slipping something?
He was also creating crime in the movie to cover.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. I mean, he was more of a gossip type guy, and I think that's all based on pretty accurate on that time. It wasn't my time, but
the 50s, right?
But there's you always had to, you know, if someone's going to give you something, there's got to be an agenda. Like, you know, if they're going to give you the something that will lead to a scandal for somebody is because they want that person out of the way so they can move up or whatever. You know, so right, you always got to be aware of that. Doesn't mean it's not newsworthy, you know, but you just are always aware of agendas. That's why you really you want to build your own sources, and it's just in a place like the LAPD, it takes a lot of time, you know.
I mean, what you were talking about is kind of the crux of L.A. Confidential, where, you know, they Kevin Spacey's character, they take away him being able to be an advisor on the TV show. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's how they get him to play ball, you know.
That's the big punishment.
Yeah.
So in addition to the Rodney King beating and then the L.A. riots that happened afterwards, your time period from 87 to 94, what were other big notable occurrences, happenings, crime situations did you cover?
Well, it was the that was the highest homicide rates the city's ever had.
Right.
It was the crack epidemic.
Right.
Really started in 84 before I got here, but it watched in. So the highest numbers of homicides in the city all occurred in the, like, 88 to 92 period. So it was a lot of, you know, there was murders every day, you know. It was just, you know, I can't think of anything that was...
North Hollywood happened after you left, right?
Yeah, that happened after I left.
And O.J. was
O.J.
Right after.
Happened a month after I left.
Oh, boy.
Right.
So I had... my O.J. story is that I was leaving, so I trained a guy to take my place. And then I was like a month into, like, hey, I'm a full-time novelist. This is what I wanted to do since I was 19. And
right.
like kind of living in that world, I had a house that had a view of the city. And, you know, when I'm in there writing my book and my wife comes in and says, you know, you got to watch this thing on TV. Yeah. And, like, I was watching it on TV and then I could look up and see the helicopter slowly, you know, OJ's run. But when he finally gave himself up, there was, like, this tremendous knot of reporters at the gates to his house. And I saw the guy who took my place. So okay. I was thinking, like, I could be here as a full-time novelist. Or I could be there, and man, I'm glad I'm not there.
I'm blanking on the guy's name. You probably know him, but he was a reporter at the LA Times, and now he's a law professor. My wife's a lawyer. And anyways, he did an auction for charity. One of the things he auctioned off was that photo, the Pulitzer Prize winning photo of the Bronco chase.
Uh-huh.
And I have it on my wall, and he tells a story on the back of it, and it was the reporter, it was like his –
Is that Miles Corwin?
I think it was. It was like his first week in L.A. He's from like Nebraska, and he had a Thomas guide. And that's why – and he didn't know where anything was, and then he just followed a news van. And then he like hopped on top of the van to get the still photo and got screamed at by the, uh-huh. you know, the video guys. But he got the shot, and it was – but it was – the whole story is written on the back of the photo, and it talks about how he, you
cool.
know – Yeah, it's really cool. But I can't – blanking on the guy's name. He was one of my wife's professors, and he worked at the LA Times.
Is this at UC Irvine?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Miles. Miles Corwin.
No. No, it wasn't Miles. It's a Jewish name.
He was – but it was Miles who auctioned it off. He didn't take the photo.
Yeah.
Because Miles was a police reporter in my era when I was there.
No.
Now he's a teacher at UC Irvine.
He is at UC Irvine, but his name's like Levy or something. Chuck uh-huh. Levy or – anyways, uh-huh. he worked at the LA Times. I knew him because him and Dan Neal like sued the LA Times at some point. So, but anyways.
Another great story.
Yeah. Well, you know, talk about the LA Times a lot. Let me ask you a question. And one of the big differences between the books and the show was Chief Irving. And what did you think? You know, because in the books he's a real villain,
right?
Kind of the villain of one of them at least. And really, Bosch is like almost nemesis, you know. And then in the show they have this wonderful relation. I mean, also like the greatest casting, you know, like. How did that difference? What did you make of it?
The key is in your own question where you compliment the casting. So the showrunner is named Eric Overmyer, and he works on a show called The Wire. So he knew many of the actors, and we've used many of the actors.
Yes, you have.
And so there is that. And any show always starts out with you're saying, let's get the best person for this, for the the role.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter what color they are or anything like that. You know, male or female, just get the best actor we can get. So we start with that, but we also analyzed Irving from the books, and Irving's only in maybe the first seven or eight of my books,
right?
And I forget whether we were on the mics when we were talking about this, but I've gotten better at what I do over time.
Yeah.
And Irving was pretty cartoonish in the books
at the beginning, yeah. And also, and just for people listening, he was a white bald guy, not a black bald guy.
Yeah,
you know, which is.
And he was just an obvious foil to Bosch, an obvious guy that was in Bosch's way, and Bosch doing the right thing, or you know, cracking the case. And so we didn't really want – we wanted to make sure we didn't have a guy who was cartoonish and being a bad
stupid
guy.
Stupid chief.
Yeah, and we wanted more like subtle Machiavellian type of guy.
Yeah.
And so Eric said Lance Reddick would be perfect for this, except he played a deputy chief on The Wire. And so we're going to have to convince him that this will be different, and over time it will be different. And I can still remember we were I was in a van scouting locations for the first episode. So I was in Boyle Heights.
Yeah.
When Eric got a call from Lance Reddick and just gave me the phone, said, convince him to take the role. And so like I was like spinning. It's not like the guy in the books. The guy in the book is not subtle. You're going to be a subtle.
Right.
A Machiavellian guy who's playing a long game that sometimes Bosch will realize what's going on and sometimes he won't.
Right.
You know, he wasn't the chief at the beginning.
Right.
You'll become the chief. You'll even think about running for mayor. So I was just kind of spinning stuff almost off the top of my head, although we did have plans to have this character, you know, become a bigger sway over the department and therefore Bosch.
Because he kind of, you know, it's funny, he kind of has like the most growth in the show, you know, like mm-hmm. Bosch is, you know, starts as a detective and then, you know, in season six quits as a detective. But like Irving, yeah, he's a mayoral candidate and he, you know, it's a fast, you know, it's also like just when him and, you know, Lance and Titus are going head to head, like the, you know, the magic that's captured on camera, like especially, you know, well, season two, obviously, but season six was just like, I don't know. It was the most different in my mind from the books where, yeah, he was not like cartoonish, but, you know, kind of just a bad guy.
Well, also, Jerry Edgar's really different, too. And he's hardly in the books
he's
at all.
He's not in the, yeah.
And he, when he's in, he's like, I kind of built, again, he's another one who's I didn't do a deep dive on character. I was so much concentrating on Bosch. These other characters are kind of cardboard thin.
Right.
In the books, in the early books.
Yep.
You know, and.
He's another guy from The Wire, right?
I mean, yeah.
So.
Is it normal for the author of the source material to be that involved in the pilot production? Where you're convincing principal actors to join?
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't really know. Uh-huh. I don't think so. but remember, the it was Amazon. Amazon sells a lot of my books, and so they kind of set that table.
Right.
And also, I'd been writing these books for at least 20 years before Amazon came along, and I wasn't just going to – I've done deals where I just give them the book and say good luck and I hope it's good. And I wasn't going to do that with the character I've invested 20 years in. So I said to them, if you want to do this, I'm coming with you, and I'm going to get certain things in a contract. You know, like
Are you listed as executive producer? Or?
Yeah.
Nice.
And like in my contract, it was like every shot had to be filmed in L.A. because the show, L.A. is a character, you know, and they could have, you know. I created a show.
Go to Toronto or Sydney
or
something.
Yeah, I created a show back in the 90s called Level 9.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And the lead was an LAPD detective, and they shot in Vancouver. And there's a truck with all these palm trees and pots. And they wherever the location is, this truck would come in, and they put up palm trees. It was just – it got canceled after six episodes, and you know, I kind of know why.
Right.
And so I learned from that. So I said, you know, Bosch and L.A. are, you know,
synonymous.
Yeah, yeah. And so you got to film it here. And they agreed.
What, was one of those experiences, does that include Lincoln Lawyer, the original, or the Netflix?
The movie, though.
The movie,
yeah. The movie's a long time ago.
I know. In terms of like you giving over your source material and they kind of ran with it in a way that maybe you didn't like, or are you, was that a – or no?
It was one of those – well, what happened was that was a 5 years from when the book came out to it became a movie. And so pretty quickly after the book came out, they sent me a script that I thought was – really needed a lot of work, and I wasn't even sure they were following the book. Like, had they read the book?
Right.
And I sent like a long, I think it was like 9 or 10 pages of notes, and then I became persona non grata. So I heard nothing for 4 years. And then someone called me up, a friend of Matthew McConaughey's who I knew, called me up and said, hey, Matthew just agreed to do this and wants to meet you. And so then I had a conversation with McConaughey, and I said, I'd be happy to meet you, but I haven't seen a script in 4 years. I don't know what you've agreed to do. And so he emailed me the script, and it was by the same writer, and it was like edition 15. So this writer had stuck with it and wrote a pretty good script. And I happened to be in Florida at that time, and I flew to Florida and read the script and met Matt, and I like just got off the plane thinking this could be a really good movie, and I can totally see McConaughey in it.
Oh, he was great. Yeah. You
know? This is 12 years ago.
No. Yeah, it came out in 2011, I think.
He had already done. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, he was established.
I
mean, yeah.
I was wondering what was his biggest movie just prior to this.
Well, it was interesting because he had gone through like he hadn't made a movie in 2 years, and he had made a bunch of rom-coms before that,
right,
and
right.
be kind of known as a rom-com guy. And so when I met him, he said, I'm rebooting my career. I took 2 years off so people would forget about me, and I have 3 or 4 projects lined up. And one of them was like Dallas Buyers Club. He told me about it like 2 or 3 years before it came out.
Right.
So he had a really good plan, and this was one of them. And this was like the first serious one he had done in many years, the Lincoln Lawyer.
The cast for that original Lincoln Lawyer movie was insane. Marissa Tomei, William H. Macy, John Leguizamo, Ryan Phillippe, Bryan Cranston. Like,
wow.
How many of those had been signed when you were talking to McConaughey?
Probably none of them.
Really?
Yeah. This was like early
stages.
He's a
big fish, right? To remind everybody else.
And then the director was like an independent film guy, and he had done a pretty good movie with Leguizamo as the star. And a lot of people in Hollywood saw that movie and wanted to work with him, so that helped as well.
Huh. So, okay.
And Cranston, when they were filming it, because I went on set a couple times, only one season of Breaking Bad had come out.
No kidding.
And it was funny. I had this – I was talking to him and telling him I really liked the show.
Yeah,
and I said, it's funny how quickly it went like this. And I did my hand down, and he thought the show went bad. And I go, oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I meant it just got dark so fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's a dark.
But I remember his face thinking, like, you're actually telling me you think the show went downhill?
Right. Yeah.
So the Lincoln Lawyer in particular, because I haven't read the book, but I did my scant little research, and I was kind of flipping back and forth between the new show, the Netflix show, and then the old. I looked at both trailers, and I was interested in that. In the McConaughey movie, he's being chauffeured in a town car, and then in the reboot as a series on Netflix, the lead is driving. He's shown driving, I think it's a 62 Continental. But then the Navigator plays apparently a much larger role. First of all, is that a product placement at all?
No.
Okay. And then what's the fascination? Like, why Lincoln Lawyers? I understand it's his office, but where'd that shtick come from?
I met a guy at a Dodger game. It was the first game. You know, they're always afternoon, like April 4th. So it was in 2001. I went to the opening day of the Dodgers and sitting next to a guy who's wearing a tie. Because he's like playing, you know, on these games are like 1 o'clock on a Tuesday,
right?
And you see a lot of people in ties because they just came over for an hour or something,
right.
Playing hooky from downtown. So I started talking to him, and he said I was a lawyer, and you know, I had that stint in Van Nuys Courthouse when I was a reporter, and there's like at that time there was like 40 courthouses in LA County, and which I didn't know. He told me, but I did say to him, "Where's your office?" You know, because then I figured I might know some people that he knows. And he says, "I work out of my car," and that was how it was born. And he said, "There's 40 courthouses in LA County, 400 miles of freeways. I have a big car. I have a trunk that can hold 3 file cabinets, and you know." And he told me the whole setup, and so I left that game knowing this is a story.
Oh,
I mean, this
great.
Is a book.
Wow.
And he drove a Lincoln? So he drove. Is that what you said?
It wasn't a Lincoln. Okay. It was. But I went with Lincoln because of the.
Alliteration.
Consonants.
But he is chauffeured in the books that I've read.
And in the show, he does. He has – that's his father's car, the old 62, and he drives now and then. And they put it into the the trailer because it looks so cool.
Right.
You know?
And I just need to tell everybody I'm very proud of myself because it's not shown fully – but I was able to.
Wow, you picked out the most iconic Lincoln.
Listen,
of all time.
I was like, I think
good
that's
job, editor of Motor Trend.
I think that's a 62, and indeed, I'm correct. So, pat on my back.
Well, speaking of that, since we're talking origins here, Hieronymus Bosch is the character's actual name, not Harry Bosch. Like a.
That's nuts.
Yeah, that's nuts. How'd that actually happen? And then B, where did Bosch come from?
Well, there's a real-life painter named Hieronymus Bosch.
I was just at the Prado looking at him.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so from the 15th century. And so I took a class when I was in college at the University of Florida, a humanities class, and the professor was stuck on Hieronymus Bosch. So we ended up studying his paintings and this guy for like 6 weeks.
Okay,
and,
wow.
And
that's a lot of
if you were
Bosch,
at the Prado and you saw the Garden of Rose and Lights,
it
stays with you.
It's super dark for those who don't know.
But also beautiful. I mean, they're like, that one, the triptych, like it starts out in, you know, Garden of Eden. It's pretty, it's.
Yeah.
And goes like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're about the wages of sin.
Right.
You know,
right.
And the consequences. And, I was well read in the mystery genre before I started writing a book, and I knew these things live and die with the character. I mean, forensics and all that fancy stuff, that's window dressing on character. The reader has to connect with a character, and so you should never miss a chance to say something, either, subliminally or right on the nose about someone's character, and that would include a name. So
right.
I wrote the first couple of drafts of the first book calling him Pierce because Raymond Chandler had written a essay on writing crime fiction, and he was talking about how a detective has to be able to pierce all levels of society, all veils, all this. He kept using the word Pierce, so I was calling him Pierce, and then I don't remember what jogged my memory about that class, but then I remembered Hieronymus Bosch, and I was writing about this guy. It didn't really turn out this way, but when I was first thinking about Harry Bosch or this character, I wanted him to be able to look at a crime scene like it's a painting and really kind of figure out what was going on. So I switched it to Bosch.
Okay. It's interesting. I always – not knowing the interpretation was – and I'm familiar with – I'm a big fan of Bosch the artist. But he does do the darkest of the dark, but his light is also really good. And I always liked that about the character was that, he's not – I don't know, your typical LAPD person in that he seems to have a lot of empathy for everybody, but also like really does want to, punish the bad people. Also has this incredible dark side, which makes him, full-figured and interesting.
I'll just say, way to paint with a broad brush and ensure yourself that you'll get a ticket every time you're pulled over in the city of Los Angeles.
Oh, I get a ticket every time I'm pulled over anyway. It's fine. Unless they recognize me. A lot of the CHP likes me. It's the LAPD that don't. They also don't – LAP doesn't pull you over. CHP pulls you over.
Right.
So and then the character, it was interesting hearing Titus talk about it where he interpreted it as this guy's an operator, this guy's special forces, and he's not a cop. He's not a normal cop. This is what Titus told me was that, I see him as like a special agent of the LAPD. Was that your intent, or is it more you were more private eye, or how did you come up with the character?
No, I mean, that's what Titus has brought to it, the operator stuff, because he's fascinated by that. And
yeah.
And the roles he's had, he had to go through training and all that.
Right.
The guy I wanted, I had worked on a construction job, you know, for my dad, and I worked on a crew that was headed by a guy who had been a tunnel rat in Vietnam.
Right.
And wouldn't really talk about it, but because I knew he did that, I did research on it. There was a book that came out in the 70s that's about tunnel rats and pretty scary stuff.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, the metaphor of tunnels and so forth, I wanted Bosch to be a tunnel rat. It was as simple as that.
And it ties into the Bosch the artist, like underground, dark, yeah. Horrors.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's far away from being an operator. These guys went into tunnels with a .45 and a flashlight. You know,
right,
that was it.
Right.
You know, and so it's not that kind of character in the books.
Right.
But, you know, when Titus is at least a decade younger than the guy in the books, and he plays a little bit younger even more. So,
yeah.
So Bosch's military would not be doing a draft period and things like that. It would be some guy who wanted to do this.
Right.
And so that lends to the operator type stuff and so forth. So
right. Yeah, because I noticed that early when I was getting into the whole thing. The whole world of it was like, yeah, it was a Vietnam vet in the books, and it was a Gulf War vet in the show. And it was right. Interesting. It's like, okay, they shifted it 20 years.
Yeah. So. I mean, it would be – it's funny that – all comes down to a budgeting question. To even set a show in 90s LA would be very expensive.
Sure.
Just the lined streets with cars and yep. things like that. So it was a really quick
decision.
And early decision. We're going to be contemporary, so therefore we need to rethink. A guy can't be a Vietnam vet, or he'd be too old because we're hoping to get a good long run out of the show.
Yeah.
You know, if it had been a movie, maybe. You know,
yeah, because it's just 2 hours.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're at the point where we need to get to cars, but I got one more question. One more
indulge
question.
Yourself.
And you're going to love it. You're going to love this one. The food. So I remember, because I think what happened with me was I watched like the first season, and then I just bought every book and just was like, oh my God, yeah. But I remember the one that I'm like, this guy really knows something. You mentioned Giamella's, you know, and yeah. I'm like, come on, that's like inside local. And I always see almost always see cops at GML's, you know, picking up some hoagies or whatever when I'm there. And like, how did you really brought like, especially the show too, but like especially the whole thing, like the food in LA is a character. The restaurants are a character.
And yeah. Like,
I mean,
it's the reporter in me that, you know, why make that part up? You know, Harry Bosch is not real. But I want him to feel real and come across as real. And I'm talking about in the books.
Yeah.
And so my idea was to take this made-up character, this fictional character, and really anchor his feet in a real landscape. And so get all that stuff right and have him go to real restaurants and things like that. You know, you guys are from L.A. and that might mean something to you, but most of the people who read these books have never even been to L.A.
Sure.
So it's really something to do with the writing process that helps
me write
these books.
Because I was going to say, why bother with restaurants? You could do, you know, whatever. But
right.
That's
– But, you know, it's just the reporter in me. Like, I know where cops would go and so forth.
Right.
They'd tell me, or I'd interview them there and so forth. So I just like using real places. I would only make up a place if I'm going to like murder somebody. In
sure.
It, you know, and because they might not like that idea. You know?
So what?
I had one of my books called Angel's Flight.
Oh, yeah.
I had two people killed on Angel's Flight. And, you know, I thought that was like public transportation. I didn't know it was privately owned and all this stuff. And I never got any permission. And one day I'm doing a signing and my head's down, I'm signing books, and someone puts a business card there and it says executive director of Angel. And I thought, okay, I'm in trouble here. But he was happy.
Right.
But he did kind of let me know I should have sought permission anyway.
Oh, that was a good book. That was a good season and a good book. That was
you have awesome. To, as a writer of fiction, you need to like let him, at least let him know?
Well, No, I technically no, but to keep good graces and so forth, you know, it did come around because we ended up more than 10 years, almost 20 years later filming there.
Yeah.
And that guy, greased the skids for us to film there.
Interesting.
So. Yeah.
So can you indulge me a second then? And call out some of the favored restaurants for
Musso and Frank's
for officers, like real, like from your research
for detectives. Are
they still around?
Yeah, no, I mean, but most of them are like taco trucks and stuff. But a big one for Hollywood Division is Bird's on Franklin.
Okay,
because they get a discount there,
And so
that's a good, really good food there. And usually when I'm in there, I see cops in there. I've gone in there to interview cops and so forth. So and they pick the place. So that's a big one. A lot of the places along in Silver Lake, just going down Sunset and so forth, that seems to be a big place. The one that never reopened after COVID is Pacific Dining Car, which is across the street from Rampart.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good scene with Chief Irvin in Pacific Dining Car.
Yeah, I'm glad we filmed in there a couple times before it went away.
And before we get to the cars,
I do want to talk about cars.
This is an awkward, delicate question. Not really. Well, no, the subject matter. Because you're in talking to you about where you were doing your coverage for the LA Times, you're north Los Angeles. You're in the Valley. Valley Bureau, also known as Porn Valley, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and you were there in an interesting time for that scene as well. Like, how much of the crime you were reporting was drugs, gangs, or this other like rising business, which is also like always talked about? It's like the dark underbelly of Hollywood.
Billion-dollar industry.
Well, it's because you know, a lot of people travel from all over the world, all over the country to come to L.A. to make it as a star. And if they fall just a little bit short, they end up in the Valley.
Plus, equipment rental is equipment rental, you know.
I mean, that was part of the beat. So the way it worked was there was a day cops and a night cops guy. And I was mostly night cops, but we would work long-term projects, and we did a lot of stuff on the porn industry because, you know, it has billions of dollars and it's all based there. There's a couple of interesting murders of people that were involved in that business that I wrote a lot of stories about.
Also, you wrote a book. I mean, there was I'm forgetting the title of it, but there was an old porn tape
I've written 37 books. So I don't remember them all.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. There's
but,
one.
But I put it this way:
where
I wrote
a porn
star
is murdered. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was a Concrete Blonde.
Concrete Blonde. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote about it as a reporter, I definitely probably wrote about it as a novelist because I had that
right
that knowledge or that information.
Mm. Right. Right. Right.
All right.
All right.
So now that we're over an hour in, let's talk about cars. Look, how much to the extent, because we talked about LA as a character, LA food as a character, LAPD as a character. LA is also known for cars.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Johnny, I'm going to ask you how much of that element ends up in the books and the.
Funny. No matter where they are, I'm sure this is intentional, but no matter where they are in LA, it's like be there in 30 minutes, which I thought was great because it's like very LA thing. But I assume that was intentional.
Yeah, and the one thing we did was make it real. In other words, most shows like the guy in Hollywood has to go to Santa Monica, and he's there, the next scene he's there.
Yeah.
We never fake that stuff.
Right.
We take the real roots and so forth. And it's interesting, the opening where I already talked about with Vin Scully and all that, the track, they follow this guy. He's a suspected serial killer, and they follow him out of Echo Park through downtown and into Boyle Heights. And the route is actually real, what they
yeah.
do. They,
yeah.
He jumps on the metro and all this kind of stuff. It's exactly the route, and
right.
like no one does that. Why do that? And who's going to care? Or who's going to know? But I know. And,
yeah,
and we just felt we wanted to do it that
I
way.
I mean, the famous one I always thought was a Pretty Woman. Richard Gere lands at LAX, and then trying to get to Beverly Hills, winds up a Burrito King in Echo Park, which is like absolutely the most ridiculous thing. Right. And then where's Beverly Hills? It's there. And like, you know, he's there a second later. And it's like, come on, you know, like, what is this? So, but as for you, I mean, I've been told, from when I started talking with Bosch people, which is, mostly my friend Mark Douglas, I'm sure he's a friend of yours. But he was like, yeah, you gotta get Michael on the show because he's a big car guy. He's got these Porsches. He's into Porsches, and then I hear you're doing some sort of EV conversion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I qualify as a car guy, but I am very lucky in that that's probably my indulgence, that I change cars a lot. I don't ever have a lot of cars, but I also have a homestead in Florida, so I have a place in Florida. I have a car there, and, you know. So anyway, this is probably a sacrilege, so I apologize to Porsche.
We're about sacrilege here.
Okay.
It's inevitable.
On the inevitable.
All right, so I have a 65 356 coupe.
Oh,
and
nice.
And I'm on a waiting list that you guys know about, Z Electric in San Diego.
Yep.
That I want to make an electric car.
Okay, why do you want to make an electric car?
Because I really like electric cars. I always seem to have there's probably an electric car other than yours that I haven't had yet. Like, so I've had Tesla, Jaguar, BMW, Taycan.
Right.
I have a.
You had a Leaf?
No, but I did have the
Bolt?
The original
EV1.
No, what's the one that BMW had that only goes 60
miles? i3.
i3.
And i3.
Okay.
I now have their iX.
Oh, what do you think of the iX?
Oh, I saw that. I saw you parking. You parked on the curb.
Yeah.
iX. What do you think of the iX?
I like it.
Yeah.
I've only had it about 4 months, I think.
Phenomenal interior.
Yeah. It's really good. I mean, so you're okay. I don't know if you guys have sponsors. You can say bad stuff or good stuff.
Yeah, we can say bad stuff.
It was interesting. I didn't like the Tesla. I'm an old guy. I'm 66. So the Taycan is a beautiful car, but I didn't like stooping down to get into it.
Yeah.
It'd give me back problems. so I really do like the iX, but I really loved, and the only one I regret giving up was the Jaguar.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
I just thought that was a really good car.
The I-Pace.
Yeah. That was a good car. And that thing was just cursed by not having competitive range. But, yeah, I mean, I had one.
We're going to unpack this in detail.
Okay. But it was fast, nice car. Yeah, just the battery just wasn't there. But, you know, now it's coming back as a Fisker. That platform is the new Fisker Ocean.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's going to have much more power, more bigger battery.
So, but you're saying that, you know, it will say you have 200 miles and you get on the freeway and it turns out you have 80, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And it was only rated at like 220 when like a Tesla Model X, which was, you know, price-wise was a competitor, was getting like 350. You know what I mean? So it's a big discrepancy.
But I want to hear from you. Where, Michael, are you driving? Are these in LA? Or are these in Bolton, Florida? Like, where is the bulk of your EV driving done? And then what is it? Is it like daily commute? Or are you actually like driving long distances? Or what's the use?
It's a little bit of both. In Florida, I don't have an electric car. I have a Defender.
Okay.
What year Defender?
New one or old one?
Paint a picture.
New one. I just got it.
Oh, nice.
After waiting a year.
SUV.
SUV of the year from 2 years ago. Yeah. We like the Defender.
The supply backup?
Supply chain. Yeah, it turns out the whole world was held together by one piece of string and then.
Yeah, and the chips. And so I just got this brand new 2 weeks ago, and they can only give me one key.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's super sadly common.
Two-door or four-door?
Four-door.
That's real common in the industry. Next time you want to call me, I got a friend who's a celebrity. I got her. The first Defender in the U.S.
So. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Let me know.
Okay, so Florida, wisely, given the weather situation, you have a super capable off-road vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay.
That actually played into it because my place is on the beach in the barrier island called Siesta Key.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Just narrowly escaped a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
If you do get a Rivian, you know, they can actually drive underwater forever. So,
really?
Yeah, it's electric. It's sealed. So it's
forever might be. We'd have to test that.
Yeah. But no, there's a great video of a guy launching a boat, and instead of backing the boat down the ramp, he just drives into the lake with the Rivian.
On purpose for once.
Yeah, waters up to about the windows, and they just float the boat off, and then he drives out. So, you know, you can do that.
Okay. So that sounds like a vehicle for Florida,
right?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's you gotta have it's a great truck. We can talk about that, but anyways, yeah, back to that. So what
LA, you have all your you've had all your EVs.
Yeah.
Okay. So i3, iPace, which Tesla was it?
The 90, I think.
So the S, Model the S sedan, 90. Not
yeah.
the
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, nice car.
And what year did you? Were you early adopter on that one, or was that?
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Wouldn't be any earlier than 2013. So we're talking like 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
You didn't. So you liked it, but you didn't. You didn't like it.
I liked it okay. I think I wanted more. I also had problems with it, like they had to replace everything once.
Yeah. That was the initial problem with Tesla. Was like the battery, the motor, and then the control arms all had to be replaced.
Yeah.
And
luckily, when it had its meltdown or whatever it was, it was in my garage, so it wasn't marooned somewhere.
Right.
But
you're 66. You've been driving EVs for almost 10 years now. Are you what's your view on the tech? Are you like I love it, I'm into it, it's too much, like lots of screens, like I guess
what, I like all that stuff.
You do?
I don't know why. I guess I'm, besides being a car guy, I'm a gadget guy, I guess. I like it. It's interesting how so many of them are the same, but then they also have their little differences and things like that. I don't know. My wife has never driven any of my cars because of that stuff. She gets like freaked out by, like, it's like you're in a plane or something, a cockpit of a plane or something.
Yeah, too many choices type thing.
Charging. You charge at home mostly?
Yeah. Okay. Totally.
So then
right.
The question I was going to ask then, if you didn't, was, you know, going from Tesla, which has its own supercharger network, it's a huge advantage.
Unless you only charge from home, that doesn't make any difference,
right? Which I guess is what I'm asking, because it is emerging as other manufacturers enter the space that supercharging, having your own bespoke, custom, you know, charging network with its own handle and the app is quite seamless, is considered by some to be a huge advantage. But what was the experience like switching from Tesla to now, a Jaguar and a BMW? I guess it's irrelevant, right? Because you're just running a charger at home.
Yeah. I mean,
I just answered the question.
I think I'm trying to remember. I just don't remember any kind of transition that as being an issue.
And there wouldn't be, right? I mean, if you charge at home, you charge. It's like, you know, you plug in your vacuum cleaner. It's just the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky and. You know, we're here in L.A., the capital of bad traffic, but I work at home. I'm a writer, you know. So in more recent years, I've had to go out a lot more because of TV shows and so forth. And so I'll go to sets and stuff like that. But I'm not putting a lot of miles on my cars. And so I don't even need a supercharger because there might be days where I don't even use my car,
sure. You
know. So, you know.
But then
so
you had like a Cayman or a couple Caymans or something like that?
I've had I never had a Cayman. That's probably the only model I've never had.
Okay, but you had like 911s and Boxsters? And,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cayennes?
I've had Cayennes.
Panamera?
My wife has a Macan. I had a Panamera. I had one of the first ones.
So you have you like Porsche?
Yeah, I've just always liked them, their looks and so forth. This old one I got is the first old one I ever had.
Yeah, it's funny because I have a 914, which is slowly being rebuilt, 1970. But all my friends are like, yeah, as soon as you've spent like, you know, $50,000 on it, you're going to have a car with 80 horsepower. You know, so that's the EV swap in a 356 does make a lot of sense.
Well, let's talk about that. So – are you swapping a perfectly good running 356? Is that what's
going on? Well, it does. It's severely underpowered. That's one reason. One is I just become an electric guy, and I studied Zelectric and looked at some of their cars and stuff. And to me, it's kind of an exciting thing, and it will make that car faster.
Okay. And you keep the old engine, right? I mean, the old engine doesn't get like, you know, thrown in a dumpster. Like if you want to sell it, you can. Here's the old engine, 4 bolts. It's a Volkswagen. Goes back in.
I never even thought about keeping it, but now maybe I will.
Yeah, just for resale. Yeah, it's the simplest thing. I'm familiar with, like, because Z-Electric does do 911s and 356s and bugs. And, you know, it's a Volkswagen motor, 4 bolts, whole thing slides out. You just keep it on the shelf. You go to sell it. You can sell it as an EV. Here's the engine. Or throw the EV stuff away, put the engine back.
I might have a guide for you if you don't want to wait. My buddy in Austin, Moment Motors, is also doing this vintage. Oh, yeah. This vintage electric transition is happening in a bunch of different spots. And he's been one of the leaders.
Moment Motors.
Moment, Mark Davis at Moment.
Oh, so, yeah. I know Mark.
I'll look that up.
Yeah. I'll switch his
name. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the thing. It is so underpowered compared to, you know, contemporary vehicles that I don't really care to drive it that much.
Right.
So you've had this car for a while. You didn't buy it expressly to do this swap.
No, I did.
Oh, you did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is a question I like to ask all the super successful famous people we have. That's true. So you were crime beat reporter. You tried two attempts at a novel. Your third one is successful. You leave the LA Times in 1994. You're a full-time novelist. I don't know when you made it big or what the big one was. But what was the splurge? What was like the,
yes,
I've made it. So now I'm going to buy
a Patek Philippe.
Or a car.
It was a car.
Yeah? What was it?
It was a Boxster.
Okay.
Oh, so it was a Porsche.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was funny. It was there. What was the first year of the Boxster?
Oh, like, you would ask that. Yeah. Oh, you would. Why would you ask that? I look like a fool, but like, yeah, 96, 97. Yeah, 98.
That's about when I felt like I could probably afford something like that.
Nice.
Okay.
And there's another writer in town, and he's a car guy. You should get him on. Named Robert Crace. I don't know.
Yeah.
Very good writer.
Okay.
And we used to meet for lunch about once a month, and. Those early Boxers mostly came in silver.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. With the maroon, the dark red interior, right?
And a black top. And I'm meeting Bob Trace for lunch, and he's in the valley on Ventura Boulevard. So I drive in my brand new Boxer I just picked up. And park at a meter, and then another duplicate pulls in front of me and parks at a meter, and he gets out.
Then you got to trade it in, right?
We just started laughing.
That's great. But hey, I mean, you made it as writers, which is like, you know, we're writers, you know, we just write for a car magazine, but like to be able to earn a living writing words is ridiculous, you know?
It's a long shot.
Yeah.
That's why it goes back to my father's idea was a pretty good one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then so you've had a lot of cars, it sounds like. You said you've gone through – you've been lucky
the
enough
Porsche
to go
catalog,
through
yeah.
many. Two questions. One is what's the one that got away when you kind of bummed you got rid of? And then tell me about the EV transition, because that's actually happening right around the time you scored and you're doing Boxsters. Like, you know, GM's got an EV1 out, Toyota comes out with the RAV4 electric.
Oh,
right?
Those are such small numbers.
I know, but then subsequently you get a
– But the Tesla was the damn
which is like – which yeah. is 10 years later. But yeah. So any vehicles that you wish you hadn't sold or gotten rid of, and then what was the transition? Like what got you into that? I assume it was the Tesla first. It could have been the i3.
No, it was the i3 was the first one I got.
Okay.
And that didn't work because of – it would have worked for me just being a novelist because of the amount of driving. But then I got my show and we were filming all over L.A. and it just –
Small range.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, because what attracted you to the i3?
I don't know. Maybe it's me worried about climate and things like that. I just thought,
right,
I'm going to try this. And then, you know, once you try it and you realize these cars go faster than anything else.
right.
It's like, never mind the climate. I just like the performance. So,
I mean, I'm kind of in that boat. Like that's why I went after the Rivian. I'm like, wait, you can get this much horsepower for like that little money? Like,
you're very soft-spoken, but you're like a speed freak. You're like really into acceleration.
Not necessarily going super fast, but I also live on Mulholland Drive, which is a winding road, and I want to have a car that, you know, that's where I'm really interested in the transition with the 356. That's going to be fun to drive on that road. And driving that now as it is, and you know, the shift is all over the place and all that.
Well, but okay, but then again, still holding out for you're the one that got away. But
well, you didn't ask it. You asked the transition question.
I know.
What's the car, electric, gas powered, whatever, that got away?
That you're like, oh man, I wish I hadn't gotten rid of that one. Or is there one?
Well, I had when I was in high school, I made money by buying Volkswagens, fixing them up, and selling them. And I did that multiple times in high school. So probably my first one, which I sold, I wish I still had. And I've looked into, you know, buying one. Same.
Which was what?
Just a 68.
Okay. I was going to say 67, but yeah, 68. Yeah.
Okay.
And but I also had a Triumph TR4A, 1968.
Oh, nice.
That just had a great paint job. And
What color?
It was yellow. Yellow? And it had a – they did this weird thing where they did the stripe, the racing stripe, across the hood.
Yes.
Not like going this way. Right. And I love that car, the way it looked. And I had that when I was in Florida. So when I moved pretty much became full-time L.A., I got rid of it. I should have just kept it or stored it.
I mean, that's a gettable car. That's not, you know. My dad had a white TR4, and then he had a yellow TR6, and he loved the 6. It was just, like, crazy about the 6.
I had a maroon TR6.
Okay.
So Boxster, TR6. You like you're a convertible guy then, Florida guy.
Yeah, except this coupe. I just love the way the coupes look.
Gorgeous design. Yeah
like it's a piece of art.
But then the question for me is a guy who likes performance cars, you like the acceleration, you like the twisties, are you not missing, and this is a common criticism of EVs, the sound?
Yeah. No, I'm not.
Really?
No. It's funny. I don't like loud cars. I mean, I don't know. I want to be respectful of neighbors or whatever. I don't like – I'm also a morning person, so I often leave the house early to get coffee or breakfast or something. I don't want to wake up people in the house. So I've never had loud cars.
Don't buy a Cadillac Escalade V.
Oh, yeah.
That's the hot tip.
That's a super loud car.
your neighbors, don't buy one.
When they announce – like so-and-so is going electric or whatever. So like I ordered a Mustang and then I just didn't take it. I didn't like it when it came. I'm on the new Cadillac. I'm on that list.
The Lyric?
Yeah. And see what that's like when it comes.
Delayed. That's like delayed at the moment. Super. I think it's like 18-month
delay. Fascinating car. Because we had your BMW iX. We had the Cadillac Lyric. We had the Nissan Ariya. Hyundai
Ioniq 5,
Kia EV6. Yeah. I'm missing like five others.
It was stacked.
We had all of these vehicles at our SUV of the year, and just drove them back to back to back to back to back. And it was very much, I tell people, it was like it's this moment where we're literally 10 years after Elon and Tesla dropped the Model S. It was our 2013 car of the year.
So we drove this in 12.
We did this in the summer of 2012 where we do our big program. We test all the vehicles. We're 10 years past that. And it's like, okay, pencils down, turn in your homework. What do you got, BMW? Oh, you got an iX. What do you got, Hyundai? Oh, you got an i5. And it's everybody's answer is like the same but different. It's everyone's putting batteries in the floor. They got motors near the wheels. But then the experience itself is wildly different depending on their approach to certain aspects of the technology. I think you've had some excellent cars that you've driven in your stable. I am very curious what you're going to think about that, about the Lyric.
Also the iX is like they did a good job. You know what I mean? Like
except the exterior, maybe.
Well, I don't.
Do you like the way it looks on the outside? People are very, very. The grill kind of drives people nuts.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it.
But the interior, I think, is. And I think what you were saying about – very, very valid about Taycan, sports car, low seating position. And what you didn't actually say is BMW, when you get in, it's like sitting on an easy chair. Like the hip point is quite high. And the seat itself is fully covered, which is really – it's a if you, right now, if you're in front of a computer, you should Google BMW iX interior. It's like all leather swath and
with nice bits. Nice wood. Like it's actually the buttons are in the wood, which is like a pretty cool thing.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I like being in it. The I like the way some of the other BMWs look better than this.
But. Right. Yeah. Do you find, and this is something I wanted to talk about with our guests who are EV savvy in particular. Because I think this is what you're getting at. You want to be respectful of your neighbors. You're a morning person. You're relative to Johnny, soft spoken. You find them meditative environments more so than internal combustion powered vehicles? Like I think about this now because I'm spending a lot of time in EV. I just drove back from our Truck of the Year program in an electric pickup truck, and it was 400 miles from Arizona in a car that doesn't make any noise. I'm just like, I'm alone with my thoughts.
I think there is that aspect.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, with the iX, I went on the launch of it and we were in Bavaria and, I was on the Autobahn. So I took it up to 125 miles an hour and set the cruise control. And I just wanted to see what kind of range you'd get at that speed. And it was like being in a jet just because it's pretty fast and yet silent and pleasant. And I was like, wow, I've never experienced this before. It's a new experience. And it was very cool.
So. We're getting a bit of a high sign here, so we're going to wrap up here. But I do want to ask, bring it back to the work that you do. Again, L.A. story. You write a lot of L.A. stories. L.A. is a character, the police and all that. Cars is a character. Will we see an electric vehicle? Are you able to write that in? Or do you have some bar for when – this is a big shift going on in the automotive business where it actually pierces the public consciousness. Right? Oh, that'll make sense. This character can drive this vehicle. Or LA is the king of Teslas right now. Everywhere you go, it's a Model 3 or a Model Y. Yeah.
Bosch drives a XJ Cherokee, by the way. So
okay.
Yeah.
is there, or are you just it's perception, adoption, all this stuff is going to lag a little bit, so probably not.
No, I mean, I'll say two things. One thing about Bosch's car was very much thought about, and it's a square car and he's like the square peg in a round hole, so we wanted his car to be emblematic of him, plus it's pretty old. But in the new show he has a guy who does all his IT stuff because he's still kind of anachronistic about all that stuff, but that guy has an electric car,
right? That's right
and, yeah, and so that character would be of this wave, I think, and so okay. We gave him electric.
So I got a way to end this. I think you might find this interesting. So currently at the Peterson Museum, a friend of ours, Magnus Walker, massive Porsche collector, and he's got an exhibit.
Yeah, I know who he is.
Okay,
yeah.
He lived in the house that Bosch in the show. He lived in that house.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, isn't that wild? I forget the name of the house, but it's where Bosch lives in the show.
I don't know if it has a name.
It's a great, stilty glass house overlooking L.A. It's off Mulholland.
It's on, I think, Blue Heights or something like that.
And so I was driving around with Magnus one day, and he's like, Bosch, I think I'm like, hey, I'm interviewing Titus tomorrow, something like that. And he's like, oh, I lived in that, in his English accent, I lived in that house for 16 months. And I was like, how did that happen? He's like, I saw it. I thought it was so cool. I just kept bugging the landlord, and finally he said, fine, you can move in for 3 months. And then he kept extending the lease 3 months and then finally gave him the boot. Huh. But just to tie Porsches and Bosch.
That was in the house that was in Heat.
Yeah.
That Robert De Niro lived in.
Right.
That movie.
Right.
So,
yeah. Okay.
So the producer of that movie is a producer on Bosch, and he has these Rolodexes from 40 years of making movies, and he just called the guy up and said, you want to rent it again?
So, right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So, cool house. 356 gets converted to, we should talk a little bit about this before we
call
it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
What's the powertrain and range? What do you think you're going to get out of Z Electric with this
It vehicle? Won't have a big range, but I don't think I really need it. It's not going to be my main car. And again, I'm on a waiting list, so I haven't gotten into any kind of tech with them at all. But on their website, they're saying 200.
Okay.
And 200 is totally usable.
Yeah.
Are they using? I'm not super familiar. Are they using Tesla batteries and motors? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a known quantity in terms of doing these conversions.
Right. Right. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I thought the range would be half that. It's pretty good if it's 200. So.
And then do you go to these cars and coffee things that he goes to? Have you been out to the – do you go on Sundays or weekends? Or are you kind of like enjoying
– No.
Busy writing?
No, I just stay at home and watch the Motor Trend channel.
Oh.
Sure, you
thank
do.
You. On that note. And that,
everybody here. I watch those – you know, that's what I did in high school. I mean, to a
right.
much lesser degree.
Like, sure.
Than those guys who are restoring things and stuff. I love those shows.
Oh, cool. Oh,
so like Chasing Cosley, like Wayne Carini, like
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. That makes sense. Oh. That tracks. Okay. Well.
Good to hear. Yeah. New book. Wait. New book. Even though this, we don't know when this podcast is going to come out, but this book comes out November
9th.
Ninth. So Desert Stars, the new, we didn't even talk about her, but it's the new Renee Ballard, Harry Bosch book. And I'm loving Ballard, by the way. Maybe that's it. Does Ballard ever get onto a TV show? Obviously.
Yeah, I hope so. What do you call it? What's the Hollywood word? It's in development.
In development. Yeah, we'll see. Okay.
Yeah,
because she's amazing. So to Ed, and for people listening, you know, Bosch in the series now is in his 70s, right?
I mean, 70, yeah, he's born in 1950.
Yeah, so he's in the books. He's old, bad knee. So like the heavy action is kind of this woman, Renee Ballard, who's now she's a homicide detective,
right.
restarting the cold case unit or something. So I'm excited about that because
I feel like you want to ask him one more question. But while you think about it,
I'm gonna 10,000.
I know because I'm gonna ask him my own because you've been indulging yourself this whole time. So think of one more.
No, I'm good.
I will ask him one indulgent.
I'm promoting his new book.
I'm gonna start. I like science fiction. The only fiction I read is science fiction, and I'm a nonfiction guy. So I loved. But I want to ask you who I should be reading because I do like this. I do like the true crime genre.
You should read Michael Connelly.
I'm gonna start at the beginning. So I will definitely start with your first book.
Yeah.
But tell me.
I'll give you a recommendation. An LA book.
Okay.
It's called Your House Will Pay by Steph Cha, CHA.
Okay.
Check that out. It's a pretty good book. It's like maybe 4 years old.
Okay.
3 years
done.
Maybe.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. I was also going to ask you why the best true crime. I don't know what true crime novel isn't Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Ooh.
True or false?
It's – what are you saying? Is it the best?
Yes.
Are you saying it's fiction?
No.
Oh, okay.
Best true – isn't it?
No, it's an important and great book, yeah.
Okay. What about –
I read it a couple times.
It's one of my favorites just from the language perspective. Yeah. And then what about Elroy?
Yeah, what about I've read lots of his stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like Elroy.
Black Dahlia. Wild. Just because it's so
– Black Dahlia's good, but you got to read like the America Quartet or the new books are just like off the hook. Like it's
– I only read the old stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. But I will start with Chuck.
Well, let me ask this. How is the next season – end with this. How's the new season of Boss shaping up? Boss Legacy, I should say.
Really good. I think it's going to be our best season.
Yeah?
And we're more than halfway through. We're – filming right now episode 7 of 10, so we're almost done.
I've been trying to get down to the set, but you know, just COVID restrictions, I can't get on because Mark's been promising me for like since season
Mark
6.
Mark will get you on.
He's trying, but COVID I've done some stuff where COVID's been a real a problem getting the, you know, the cameras to roll, so I'm cool with it. But
yeah, I mean, most of the agreements, like with the Screen Actors Guild, is like no visitors. But if you, they have a protocol where if they test you one day, you can come the next day.
Yeah.
Aren't you trying to get on and be?
Yes, I want to be a corpse or you know.
Can you get your SAG card being a corpse?
I don't care about my SAG card. I just want. I mean, Titus and Mark were like, yeah, we'll make you like, you know, you just be a dead body or something, you know.
I don't know if the world needs to see that because that probably means you can be naked under a sheet or
whatever,
something.
Whatever, man. Whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, with that happy visual, thank you, Michael,
yeah.
Mike Connolly. We'd love to have you in after the conversion happens, and let's talk about your next TVs. And if you ever want to come out and drive some cars,
anything. Let me. Yeah.
We're by the LA Times new headquarters. We're in El Segundo, so just give us a shout. And we got stuff all the time.
And I'm up near Glendale, so you know. So, yeah, we got all kinds of good stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.